Now, detonate the reality bomb!
Jesus Christ, you're a man.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know, catapults of propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
We've reached a point in human history where we think we're beyond the barbaric concept of a holy war. But as we look at the headlines around us here in late 2015, we may in fact be facing what could be the final crusade. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. Our guest has been doing a lot of research on this area, and I've been privileged to have an early look at some of his forthcoming work. And it is so far, and I'm not stretching a point here or trying to exaggerate, the most insightful analysis of what's happening in the Middle East right now that I've read to date. He's the co-author of the books Petrus Romanus, Exo Vaticana, and On the Path of the Immortals, the author of an important book for your research library, The Supernatural Worldview, and a featured speaker at the forthcoming Strategic Perspectives Conference in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. That is next weekend, October 23rd through the 25th. It is our honor to welcome Chris Putnam back to the program. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Derek, it's great to be back on View from the Bunker with you.
Well, it's I especially appreciate you taking time out of your schedule, because I know you're working on writing a new book, and you're also getting ready for the conference next week, which you were invited to fill the shoes of Tom Horn, who's elected to withdraw from the conference. So you've got a lot on your plate right at the moment. So, again, I appreciate you letting me take up some of your time today. We talk about a holy war. The Islamic State has essentially declared holy war against the West, and I think whether or not we in the West want to admit it, and as Christians, I think we're hesitant to admit it because we don't feel like this is something that we should be a part of. We may be actually involved in this, but there's more to it than just the geopolitical situation. As Christians, we understand that the news reports that we see are just descriptions of the shadows of the real battle taking place in the spirit realm. So what are you seeing taking place in the Middle East, and how does it relate to what this struggle with the powers, principalities, thrones, and dominions that the Apostle Paul warned us about?
Well, that's a lot to talk about. I'll start out with what you mentioned about holy war. That term, to most people, you know, it's just kind of nebulous, but if you've ever taken a course in ethics, especially studied the ethics of warfare, that is a very incendiary term. It really is a synonym for crusade.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, what distinguishes in the field of ethics a crusade theory of war versus something like a just war theory is that in crusade theory, anything goes. It's good versus evil. So if you are on the side of good, it does not matter what you do to win. There are no ethics. Anything is justified.
Mm-hmm.
This explains the beheadings, the atrocities that we see ISIS committing. They operate from a true crusade theory of war. Now, when you go back and read, you know, what the Catholic Church and the Crusaders did in the Middle Ages, where they slaughtered people and burned them alive and things like that in Jerusalem during the First Crusade. It was awful. They killed as many Jews as they did Arabs. And it's an atrocity. But in their minds, that level of atrocity is justified by the command of God. Now, we can't be too critical about that. As awful as it sounds to us, read the book of Deuteronomy, what God, Yahweh, tells, you know, Joshua to do in the Promised Land. It's the same thing. Don't leave anything alive. Kill even the animals.
Yes, it's a concept.
Slaughter the babies. Don't leave the children alive. So we see a crusade theory of war in the Torah. It's there. The difference is that we believe Yahweh is a real God.
Yeah.
And in the other cases, we think that it's a false God, and we think that it was a deception. We don't believe Muhammad when he said it was a holy war.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the difference. We do believe Yahweh, and we think that there were probably good reasons that he wanted everything living killed. One of them, you know, is somewhat controversial, is that they weren't fully human. A lot of people think that the Nephilim genetics had, you know, infiltrated into this region of Canaan, and that there were a lot of giants there, and the people that weren't giants still had some giant DNA or whatever it is, and that God wanted every living thing killed for that reason. That kind of makes some sense to me. You know, it doesn't fully explain everything, but it does add up. That maybe that would make it more reasonable. But when we see ISIS operating from a crusade theory of war, you know, that's a lot more scary because we don't believe their actual claim to deity, you know, told them to do this. ISIS recruits mainly by alluring young warriors into sex. They promise them wives. So when you look at ISIS propaganda, you can have all the wives you want, and you'll be a hero, okay? And this is, you know, violence and sex is the way ISIS recruits, and they have thousands upon thousands of young recruits showing up in Syria all the time. So every time that we run a bombing raid and kill, you know, several thousand of them, several thousand more show up from the promise of adventure and a wife and, you know, a fun life.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not really working. But a crusade theory of war, it really does entail anything goes. The means do justify the end.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the end do justify the means, I mean. So, I mean, they think that, you know, the caliphate over the world, you know, and the coming of the Mahdi will justify anything that they do. Now, you look at what's happened in Syria. Syria went from 1.2 million Christians to around 30,000 or so today. Or less, probably it's less, because I looked a couple weeks ago. So 1.2 million Christians in Syria, one of the oldest Christian populations in the world, is reduced to 30,000. That doesn't mean they're all dead, but there are displaced, and we don't know where they are. We don't know how many are dead. We do know that the Obama administration and the military have been cooking intelligence reports, you know, not telling us the truth, painting a rosier picture than what it really is.
Mm-hmm.
So if we know that 750,000 people are missing right now, and that's a rosy picture, I don't really know how bad it is.
Yeah, and the same holds true for Iraq, the same kind of destruction of the Christian populations there, over 1 million down to about 20,000 is the last time I checked. And sadly, as I'm reading a new book by Annie Jacobson, The Pentagon's Brain, which is a history of DARPA, we're finding out that the guys that were tasked by the military with assessing the situation in Vietnam, we're cooking the intelligence then to fit with
right.
What the White House wanted to hear. So in 50 years, we've learned nothing, or perhaps the actual goal of the White House, the actual goal of those pulling the strings of the White House is different from what we're being told. Maybe,
yeah.
Maybe we're not really trying to defeat. In fact, Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister of Russia, kind of implied that. It's like, well, the Americans have been bombing the Islamic State for a full year, and they've not really degraded their capabilities at all. Maybe they're not trying very hard. So, you know, and that
interestingly,
gets...
Interestingly, ISIS is driving around in our Humvees and tanks in the meantime.
Yes, exactly. And the new Toyota Hilux pickup trucks that were paid for by American taxpayers as well. So maybe there's something more going on here, and that's where we come to the spiritual part of this. What is motivating what's going on behind the scenes, and how does all this play out? You know, what is the goal of ISIS, and how does the Vatican fit into this, and the remarks that Pope Francis made about perhaps
right.
This would qualify as a just war.
Yeah, and that really was the main book idea. You know, when Tom first came to me, guys, we need to work on a book on this. You know, maybe we'll call it The Last Crusade. I don't know if that's going to be the name yet. That's kind of tentative. But Pope Francis came out and basically used a lot of, you know, hot terminology that is used within St. Thomas Aquinas's just war theory, and it goes back to Augustine. But yeah, it's the idea that there are times when war is necessary, and I absolutely agree with that. I mean, I'm not a pacifist. I think that there is a lot of evil in the world, and governments do have a responsibility to stop evil. And, you know, the thing is it just? And just war theory tries to determine that. You know, do we have a just cause? Is our response proportional to the threat? You know, and, you know, we don't have a great record in that You know, I was thinking about it. Look at World War II. A lot of people think that was a just war. And it seems like it was when you look at Europe and the Holocaust and all that. But at the end of it, we nuked two cities, and the Japanese were pretty much already defeated when we did it.
Right, right.
So was that a proportional response? I don't think so. You know, so we're not perfect. And we don't have a great reputation worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
We're known as oppressors by most people in the majority world. So, you know, I don't really know what to make of it all, but the Catholics have a whole theology of just war. Islam definitely works from a crusade theory of war. But what troubles me the most is that I found out that most of the Catholic Church is under the sway of liberation theology. Now, this was a KGB-inspired movement, and there's no doubt about that at this point. The prelate of the Russian Orthodox Church, Patrick Krill, also the Archbishop of Moscow, he's basically the Pope of the Russian Orthodox Church. He was a KGB asset. He promoted liberation theology.
Really?
So was Vladimir Putin, was a KGB asset. So these guys have already declared a holy war, an actual crusade against ISIS.
So the Orthodox Church, Russian Orthodox Church, has already gone official, made this officially essentially a crusade.
Crusade. Huh. They have said the word crusade, yes. They use the word holy word specifically in the press, no doubt about it, which means anything goes.
Huh. And who would have thought at any point in American history, after the rise to power of the communists, you know, during World War One, that we would see Russia essentially positioning itself in the eyes of the world as the defender of Christendom?
Right. And Vladimir Putin, you know, is going around with his chest sticking out and all these bare-chested photos and looking like a real man, saying, I'm standing up to evil and, you know, outlawing homosexuality in Russia. And to a lot of American conservatives, he's starting to look good. I think he's a really good candidate for GOG.
You know, it is surprising, though, but a lot of American Christians, after the legalization of homosexual marriage, or by the Supreme Court, remembering the stance of the Russian government on homosexuality,
right,
around the time of the Olympics, said, uh-huh, you know, well, yeah, maybe we just move to Russia. It's like, what? Wait a minute here.
What they don't know about Vladimir Putin is, if you're a journalist and you disagreed with him, you're probably in prison for life right now.
Yeah.
This is not a nice man. Most of his enemies are probably dead.
Yeah.
So we're not talking about a real Christian here. You know, it's lip service. And, you know, he might stand for strong morality, but he's brutal. And he'll kill you in a heartbeat if he thinks you're a threat to him.
Yeah, suffer an accident, fall.
He's not the kind of person that we would call Christ-like.
No, it's like the from the movie, I forget the title of the movie, but anyway, one of the characters talks about her father suffering an accident where he fell down an elevator shaft onto some bullets. So that is the fate that awaits many contrarian journalists in Russia.
There's an article I posted on Facebook just like a couple days ago. I got it from Madalena. That is a toll of all the journalists that have disappeared during that disagreed with Vladimir Putin, and it's astounding.
Hmm.
I mean, all the Russian journalists who just vanished, that because they expressed opinions contrary to his administration. So it's pretty much a record of murder.
Hmm. But it is interesting, though, and I'm looking at the article from Christian Today. Christian Today from October 2nd, Russia, and I'm quoting now, Russia is waging a holy war in Syria to protect innocent Christians against the tyranny of terrorism. This is from the patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church.
And the guy that runs the Russian Orthodox Church is from KGB, and the president is from the KGB.
Hmm.
And, you know, we have every reason not to trust these guys.
Well,
people that did not grow up in the Cold War don't know what we're talking about. They might think that we're silly or paranoid, but Russia was the greatest threat to nuking the whole planet that ever existed when I was growing up, and I haven't forgotten that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Read the history of DARPA, and it helps broaden your opinion just a little bit, because both sides were at risk of nuking the planet. Lawrence Livermore Laboratory.
I mean, the United States was just guilty. I agree.
Yeah. I just learned the other day that during the Cuban Missile Crisis, there were four nuclear warheads that were detonated during the Cuban Missile Crisis, two by each side,
right.
two by each side in the upper atmosphere. And, you know, it's... Well,
My father was an engineer at the Sandias Corporation, which is one of the main military-industrial complex organizations, and he told me some stories that will curl your hair that I can't say on the air. But I'm very familiar with the danger that this whole thing has been. And the thing is, it's not over. Russia has increased their nuclear arsenal in recent years while we've decreased ours.
Right.
And now they have more than we do. And we used to outnumber them. Now we don't.
Yeah.
They're actually in a position right now to take us out.
Well, you know, it's their way of counterbalancing our superiority in conventional forces. So, you know, the world isn't as a kind, gentle place. It never has
None.
Been. Interestingly, as we record this on the 18th of October in 2015, on Friday of this past week, Russian forces, Russian air support, backed up Syrian government troops along with Hezbollah, Iranian Republican Guard forces, and also a contingent of troops from Cuba.
Right.
In launching an assault on Aleppo and the area around Aleppo. And, of course, you're very much aware that area.
They didn't hit the big.
Yeah. Well,
the thing that's interesting, like we talked about this in email, is that there is a war by proxy going on between the United States and Russia right now, just like Vietnam.
Yes.
We are supporting insurgents against Assad, not ISIS, but some other groups that are rebel groups against the Assad government. We're supporting them. Russia is defending Assad.
Right.
Okay. We have a common enemy, and that's ISIS. ISIS is attacking Assad, but we don't like ISIS either, so we're attacking ISIS. Russia is attacking ISIS, the United States is attacking ISIS, but Russia is attacking all these anti-Assad forces that Obama is funding at the same time. So there's a war by proxy, but it's real complicated because everybody hates ISIS.
Right, and ISIS hates everybody.
That's kind of where it stands right now, it seems like.
And Russia's, when you look at where their attacks have been launched and this initiative to retake Aleppo, which is the largest city in Syria, about 2 million people, it's clear that their objective is to protect the administration of Bashar Assad. The U.S. is trying to support some rebels, like the Syrian Free Army or Free Syrian Army, and certain other groups, certainly the Kurds. But then we've got the Turks, who will let us use their airbase, but only if we don't support the Turks. Last week, we dropped like 50 tons of ammunition into Syria, but we had to say, well, none of it's going to the Kurds. It's going to this new coalition of Syrian rebel groups, and if they just happen to share some with the Kurds, well, that's up to them. And it turned out that nobody had ever heard of some of these groups before. Essentially, what it comes down to is it appears we lied to Turkey so that we could drop weapons to the Kurds. You're right. It is a mess.
It's kind of absurd. It really is. And what I found out in my initial research, I was watching a PBS documentary about ISIS and Assad. And at the beginning of the war in 2014, they were selling each other power.
Yeah.
Like, they were fighting each other, but ISIS was selling oil to Assad, and Assad was selling electricity to ISIS during the battle.
Yeah. And again, there are
kind of absurd.
There are historic precedents for that, too. There was a lot of trade that went back and forth across the Mason-Dixon line during the American Civil War. So
I could imagine it was necessary, yeah.
Yeah. So Dabiq, which is the town that ISIS believes was prophesied in one of the hadiths as the site of the climactic battle against the forces of Rome, is not that far from Aleppo. It's a little bit northeast
of Aleppo. It's 25 miles as the crow flies. I did it on Google Earth yesterday.
Okay. It's closer than I thought.
It takes an hour to drive there, but like 58 minutes to drive there. But if you go a straight line on Google Earth, it's 25 miles.
Yeah. The question is how fast can tanks cross that distance?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I read an essay a columnist wrote probably 6 months ago when I started researching this, and he said it would be the dumbest thing in the world to try to invade Dubuque because that's where they're waiting for us. I mean, that's what all the prophecies say. That's where they probably have a big, huge trap waiting for us. And I think he's probably right because, I mean, they have so much invested in that. That's what they call their propaganda magazine, Dubuque.
Right.
That's the name of their magazine. And they think, you know, when the last crusader dies at Dubuque, that's when they're going to take Constantinople and the kill of the Antichrist and all this stuff. So in their prophecies, Dubuque is really essential. But they actually say Aleppo and Dubuque. the city of Aleppo is actually mentioned in that same prophecy if you look carefully.
I'll have to go back and reread, because I read the Hadith to make sure that I was understanding it properly.
It says Aleppo and or Dubik, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, the battle is on, going on this weekend. I've not seen any reports that I can cite with any confidence. It's really hard to know what to trust. So,
as far as I know, the Mahdi is not here.
Yeah.
and to be honest with you, I'm going to take the tack that most Islamic eschatology is plagiarized from the New Testament and the Old Testament, and it's just given the Muslim spin, the same way they did with Ishmael and Isaac. You know, instead of the son of the prophets being Isaac, they turned it into Ishmael. And then if you ask them who Isaac was supposed to sacrifice on the mountain, they'll say it was Ishmael. But it's completely in disagreement with all the oldest scrolls. We have Dead Sea Scrolls going back into 300 B.C. that confirm that Isaac was the chosen son. You know, and we're talking about 700 A.D., the Muslims want to revise that. You know, come on. Nobody believes that. And anyway, so this is their claim. They really thrive on revisionism. They take our scripture and then they make themselves the hero. This is, it's a known pattern. Scholars see it all over the place. You can find plagiarism throughout the Quran. So when you look at this, you know, who's the Mahdi? Well, what I found out is that the Catholics in 6th century Syria, right where all the Hadith were composed, near Damascus, that there was a story of the great Catholic monarch. He was going to be the king of France. He was going to be this great Catholic king who's going to turn the whole world Catholic, and then Jesus was going to return. This was essential. I mean, this was like right next to the book of Daniel and the book of Revelation up until the year 1400. This is one of the dominant eschatological beliefs that Christians actually believed in. And these early Hadith scholars knew about that. They certainly knew about it. They heard it. They lived in Syria, and they were familiar with the literature. They turned that into the Mahdi. And it's pretty obvious to me that that's all it is. It's a great Islamic king. He turns into a caliphate and turns the whole world Muslim. And then Jesus comes back. It's the same story. They just made it Muslim. And it's real obvious, and scholars have written papers showing the parallels, and it's not going to be that hard to make the case.
Now, you mentioned liberation theology, and I think it's significant that Pope Francis, Jorge Bergoglio, was a Jesuit priest in South America, where the Jesuits have really spread the doctrine of liberation theology.
Right.
How does that factor into what's taking place, you know, the Vatican's response to all of this right now, and other initiatives taken by Pope Francis?
Right. Well, in the book, I've got a chapter that I've just tentatively called Pope Francis the Destroyer. I mean, that's what I called it. We might change that before it's all put in print. But and I'm basing that on the prophecy given by his namesake, St. Francis of Assisi. And he said that, you know, in the tribulation of those days, there will be a pope who's non-canonically elected. Okay? Now, in support of that, I would say we just found out that Pope Francis was elected by an anti-Benedictine conspiracy by cardinals who forced Benedict out of office so they could put a more progressive candidate in office that they liked better. Now, I think that's a conspiracy. I don't think that's canonical.
Yeah, so that's really intriguing.
He's non-canonically elected right from that. Well, anyway, whether that's true or not, I don't know, but that's my argument. And then it says that many people will trample underfoot the truth. In those days, Jesus Christ will send them not a true pastor, but a destroyer. And I'm identifying this guy as Pope Francis. Now, the way I do that is I connect him to all kinds of socialist statements that he's making that sound just like the Communist Manifesto. He's calling for the redistribution of wealth. He's calling for making a one-world religion. He's having Islamic prayer services in the Vatican while he's meeting with Shimon Peres and calling Yasser Arafat an angel of peace. I mean, it's really obvious to me that this guy is twisted, and he's lost the gospel. The problem with Latin American liberation theology is it really was a KGB connection. That's been proven. A Romanian secret police officer who defected during the Carter administration has testified that he knows for a fact that the KGB concocted liberation theology. Then they used Patrick Krill before he was the prelate of the Russian Orthodox Church. He was still a little lower level. He was a bishop or something. But they used Patrick Krill as the agent to promote it in Latin America and teach it to all these priests so that they would adopt a communist ideology. And they did this on purpose. Hmm. So Pope Benedict, you know, being Bergoglio in Argentina as a young priest in the 60s, there's no way that he did not escape this influence. And then when you read his statements, I cite him over and over again in encyclicals and speeches where he's talking about the redistribution of wealth, which is the same thing Marx talked about. Mm. And it's very clear that that's what he means. He means the redistribution of wealth. And he talks about how the world, I mean, he's right when he says, you know, the top 2-3% of the world could feed the hungry 7 times over with their income.
Yeah.
That's true. And it is unjust. But the problem is it doesn't take into account the fact that man has fallen. And there's no human authority on earth who's capable of equitably distributing the wealth. Only Jesus Christ can do that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, man is corrupt. And when we put this in charge of the state, we end up with corruption. We end up with communism. We end up with the USSR. We end up with Mao in China. We end up with millions of people dead in the name of atheism.
Mm-hmm.
That's what always happens, and we know that. The 20th century taught us that. So the socialist stuff, it assumes that man is good at heart, and the Bible tells us the opposite. The Bible tells us that the heart is deceitful above all things. Who could trust it?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's wrong for the Pope to be promoting socialism.
It's almost as though Jesus really knew what he was talking about when he said, the poor you will always have with you.
He did.
Yeah. Hmm.
And then you recall Judas complaining when she broke the perfume on Jesus right before his crucifixion. And he said, we could have sold that and gave them, you know, fed the poor.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus said, you don't know. You know, you'll always have the poor with me,
yeah,
but you'll only have me with you a short time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so it was actually Judas who was promoting socialism.
Yeah, exactly. And we know that what kind of a guy he was. Let's get, backtrack just a second, because I think people may be still kind of waiting for a little elaboration on that statement about the conspiracy that got Pope Francis elected. The new biography, Cardinal Daniels of Belgium. What was in that biography that he revealed, and what sort of admission did he make?
Yeah, I haven't read it because it's in a different language, but from all the online reports I've read by people who can read it, they say that what he's saying is that there was a cabal, a small group of cardinals who wanted to replace a traditionalist like Pope Benedict, who they saw as being too traditionalist, with somebody like Bergoglio, who was a lot more liberal and more amicable to the causes that they liked, like, you know, giving homosexuals a break and, you know, ordaining women and these kind of ideas. They want to be more progressive. So they wanted Bergoglio in office, and they wanted to get rid of Benedict. And so they actually petitioned to make Benedict step down, I think, because of his health. I think they, you know, encouraged him that way anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And so by conspiracy, they got him replaced by somebody much more progressive.
Yeah, and there have been whispers inside the Vatican by people who watch the Vatican far more closely than I do, that was aware or at least sensed that there was a group that was resisting Benedict in what he was trying to do and really frustrating his efforts to hold the line on certain issues. And Francis,
and that would be the same group. I mean, Malachi Martin called them the super force. You know, your friend William H. Kennedy, he called them Lucifer's Lodge. But
yeah,
he got that from Martin. Martin called them either Lucifer's Lodge or the Superforce. They were synonyms. And he said that there was a cabal of cardinals, high-ranking prelates, who actually worshiped the devil. A lot of them are Freemasons as well. But they're high-ranking Catholic officials.
Mm-hmm.
And they are the ones that are promoting modernism and progressivism and, you know, things like, you know, the advocacy of homosexuality and homosexual priests and all that kind of sort,
mm-hmm,
sort of nonsense. But that's what Malachi Martin was raving about, you know, starting with his first book, The Jesuits. He said there's a war between the Jesuit order and the papacy. Now, you know, that war has been decided. The Jesuits won. We have a Jesuit pope. You know, it's obvious. The Jesuits won that war. But Martin warned of a second war. And he said this war was for the control of the New World Order. Now, I think Martin made a mistake because he was writing in 1990, so he couldn't see everything that was happening now. But he wrote that that three-way war for the control of the New World Order was between the Roman Catholic Church, Marxism, the Russians, basically then, the Soviet Union, and Western capitalism led by the financial elites, you know, like the Bilderbergers and, you know, the Rockefellers and those types. So he saw it as a three-way war for control of the New World Order. Now, what he didn't see was the likelihood that the Roman Catholic Church and Marxism could merge into one candidate. And that's what we have with Pope Francis, quite obviously. That's what I'm arguing in the book. So I'm kind of giving away the punchline a little bit, but you guys can look forward to hearing, to reading the book very soon, where I'll detail and document every fact that I'm talking about with really authentic documentation, not just cheesy articles.
Yeah.
I think this is really happening. I'm not saying he's the false prophet for sure, but the thesis that we put forth in Petrus Romanus, the final pope who's here, I think it still stands. I'm not saying it's proven, but I'm not saying it's falsified either. For it to be falsified, Rome will have to not be destroyed during his papacy, and he won't be able to call down fire like the false prophet. Those things will falsify that in my mind. If he retires or something like that and Rome doesn't burn, then he was not Petrus Romanus.
No.
But so far, nothing has defalsified him, and it's on track to be the case.
Well, we'll
see. Everything that he has done so far kind of leads me to think he really could be the guy.
Yeah. Well, we'll keep an eye on that. He has made some moves to move the church in a leftward direction. He demoted a very influential Cardinal Raymond Burke, who was formerly the Archbishop of St. Louis. He was the Archbishop there while we lived in St. Louis, and known as a very staunch conservative. He was demoted. He was not invited to a synod that is taking place in Rome as we record this. It's a three-week gathering of bishops from all over the world to discuss issues of faith and the family in particular, and how the Roman Catholic Church deals with family. And at the beginning of this conference, apparently, and again, this is another case where we don't have real solid information because the story is changing from week to week. Apparently, there was a letter that was handed to Pope Francis by Cardinal George Pell. He's an Australian. He's head of the Vatican's finances. It was supposed to be signed by 13 cardinals.
And half of them didn't even sign it. Right.
Well, at least four of them that I know of have said that they didn't actually sign it, and that Cardinal Pell, his role in this may have been overstated. So, you know, the information is pretty tightly controlled coming out of the Vatican. And
Long record of forging documents, by the way.
Well,
it goes way back.
But the interesting thing,
Petrus Romanus. The worst thing they ever did was the donation of Constantine. That's when they claimed that when Constantine moved the Roman Empire, the capital, to Constantinople from Rome, that he left all the land around Rome to the Catholic Church. Okay? He never did that. They wrote the letter like 200 years later. They faked it. And they used a style of Latin that didn't even exist when Constantine was alive. So scholars figured it out real quick. It was fake. But that was their original claim to the papal states.
Wow.
The whole papal state that they owned, a whole block of land, was the donation of Constantine. But it was fake the whole time.
How about that? Well, the interesting
that's true.
Pope Francis, on the second day of this synod, actually stood up and addressed the gathering and said, don't give in to conspiracy theories. So something is going on inside the Roman Catholic Church right now that we are not quite aware of, but it does appear.
He knows there's a conspiracy.
Yeah.
He knows. That he was elected by conspiracy.
Exactly.
Nobody writes that in a biography for no reason.
Sharon made an interesting observation recently. She said everybody is saying that Pope Francis took his name from Francis of Assisi. She thinks it's more likely
that Jesuit Francis.
Francis Xavier, co-founder of the Society of Jesus. Yeah, the guy was a friend of Ignatius at Loyola.
I tried to pursue that, but Pope Francis actually said that he took it from St. Francis.
Yeah, that's what he said.
So. He claimed that anyway. But yeah, there is a Francis Xavier who's much more nefarious.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, the apocalypse of ISIS, they are looking for this climactic battle at the beak. And, of course, now we've got the Russian forces backed by the Russian Orthodox Church in their holy war alongside Syrian forces and Shia forces from Hezbollah and from the Iranian Republican Guard. presumably Catholic troops from Cuba, who apparently are there to operate some of the tanks that are moving into position as they move toward Aleppo. It's a bizarre coalition.
So it's basically the communists coming against ISIS.
Yeah, it's kind of an odd situation there. The thing that
NATO.
Because NATO doesn't know what to do. We're kind of standing on the sidelines now, just saying, well, you know,
hey, let them do it this time, really.
Yeah. What's really interesting, though, is that here in America, over the last 10 or 12 years, we've been constantly beating the drum about the threat posed by Iran and a nuclear Iran. And I don't belittle that, although I don't think that the Iranians are quite as eager to use a nuclear weapon as Sean Hannity might want us to think.
Timothy Furnish, and he's been a big influence on my research, and he says that he doesn't think Iran has any vested interest in using a nuke. And I believe Dr. Furnish. But groups like ISIS, they really are trying to hotwire the apocalypse. They really believe they could bring the end times on by their own actions.
Yeah.
They truly believe that, and they're acting that way.
So the question is,
they're more dangerous than Iran.
Yeah, and the question from my perspective is, and why have we fixated on Shia eschatology, which Dr. Furnish very
Sunni is much more diabolical in a way.
And what Dr. Furnish calls Mahdism, this belief.
It's much more apocalyptic and scary. I'm writing a lot about Mahdism, and I'm quoting Dr. Furnish, mainly from you telling me about him, so I'll give you credit there. But I bought all his books, and I've been reading them. And he's an expert on Mahdism. He spoke at a lot of scholarly conferences on Mahdism. Mm-hmm. I didn't even know there was such a thing. But the universities have like five or six scholars like having a big, you know, round table about Mahdism now. Apparently, you know, obviously our CIA and our military needs to know about it. So they're learning everything they can from these scholars.
Yeah, the sad thing is that Dr. Furnish was a regular instructor at certain schools for the military, and he was disinvited when the current administration came into the White House.
Well, Obama doesn't want to fight the Muslims.
Or at least he wants to pick and choose which Muslims we want to fight. But again, it seems here in America
he won't admit it has anything to do with Islam either.
Well, that's true.
He avoids that. Yeah, right. He wants it to have nothing to do with Islam. It's just terrorists or, you know, for some nebulous reason. Obviously, it has to do with Islam.
And the funny,
just avoiding the obvious just makes you look stupid.
Either stupid or complicit, and I'm not sure which is worse. But
I put three theories in my book: that he was complicit, that he was stupid, or that he's being played by the powers of principalities.
Mm.
And I put it's probably a combination. So I think he's stupid, but I mean, and I think he's smart in a lot of ways too, but I think he's being played by the globalists. I mean, to be elected president, you have to be approved by the globalists. Just to have the money to run the TV ads and run the election, you have to be approved by the most powerful people. So by the time you get in a position to be elected president, they've already picked both sides, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
So whoever wins, they win. Their agenda really runs right up the middle of the Democrats and Republicans. So I don't get real upset about American political debate because I don't believe either one of them. I don't. I think they're both bought and paid for.
No, absolutely. But here in America, we've really fixated on this idea that the 12th Imam, the Shia eschatology, is the one to worry about, instead of the Sunni eschatology, which I agree with
is far
more dangerous. So why have we picked
Shia
one over the other?
I don't know. I mean, I kind of think that that's a diversion. I'm writing that in my book, that I think it's somewhat of a diversion. I think that the Sunnis are a lot more dangerous and they have more money. And they have more to lose. I mean, Iran has more to lose. Iran doesn't really want to start a nuclear war as bad as Ahmadinejad might have seemed. I think that the Iranian people really just want modern conveniences. They want to live like Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't want an apocalyptic battle. But people like ISIS definitely do.
Yeah, because they're true believers. I see the ruling mullahs in Iran as similar to the Sanhedrin of Jesus' day. It's like, well, you know, if this guy really is God and he comes in, we're out of our phony baloney jobs. So, you know.
Yeah.
I see the mullahs as the same deal. You know, we don't want the 12th Imam to come because if he comes, then we don't have any, you know, we lose our cars, our wives, and our nice houses.
Yeah.
We're done. So,
So where
does all this lead? I mean, we've got some sort of a confrontation that is shaping up in the Middle East.
I'm, Well, Derek, I am arguing that this is ultimately leading to Armageddon. And I know that you're one of the few people that read Dr. Heiser's Islam and Armageddon from way back in, what was it, 2001 or 2 or something?
Something like that. And I need to go back and reread it. Yeah.
Yeah, it was way back. But I've read it, and I've studied a lot in the process of reading this book, of writing this book, too. And I think, you know, a lot of his conclusions then still hold. You know, I don't want to just paraphrase his book, but I'm using a lot of his ideas, and I'll just credit Dr. Heiser with that. And he probably doesn't stand by all of them now. I think some of his opinions might have changed, but the way he was thinking then is basically the way I'm thinking now. I mean, I'm not convinced that the Antichrist has to be a Muslim or anything like that by any means. He could be Jewish, he could be a European, whatever. But I think the idea that the Antichrist will be the one who unites Judaism and the Muslims somehow, and they rebuild a third temple somehow coexisting, this whole popular coexist idea, that I really think that's going to be the Antichrist agenda. I think that will be a third world religion based in Jerusalem, possibly with the Pope in charge. You know, he's already having Islamic prayer services in the Vatican, so how far are we from something like that? Maybe it's not that far. That's kind of what that's my trajectory. So I've seen that and some kind of, you know, peace agreement between the Muslims and the Jews, two-state solution, however they manage to do that. And that'll be the covenant in Daniel. Chapter 9, the covenant with many. So, you know, I'm thinking that that's probably the way it's going to go down. And it looks like it's sizing up that way. Pope Francis is certainly doing everything he can to facilitate it.
Hmm. Well, in the interest of keeping your schedule a little more clear for the balance of the week, and because I can smell that we've got meatloaf that's almost ready to come out of the oven, if not already out, I'm gonna leave you just one final question. I'm looking at the Strategic Perspectives Conference and your notes at your website, logosepologia.org.
Right.
You're talking about astrobiology, the science with nothing to study. At in Coeur d'Alene, and also, who are the immortals? If you just maybe a one or two sentence thesis of what people can expect of those talks.
Well, the astrobiology talk is based on my chapter in the book Exo Vaticana. I have an astrobiology chapter in that book, and basically, it's the marriage of astronomy, the study of space, and the study of life, right? Astrobiology.
Mm-hmm.
And do we know of any life in space? No. So you can get a PhD in a science that has no subject. That's kind of a joke, but it's true. So anyway, I'm going to talk about why Earth-like planets aren't really Earth-like, and a lot of the stuff that we read in the media is not really true. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
In the second talk, who are the immortals? Well, Tom Horn and I just released the book, you know, On the Path of the Immortals. So I'm going to explain what do I mean by the term immortals. And, you know, the trajectory of that book and how we end up running around looking at the Anastasia Indians when we're actually talking about fallen angels.
It's fascinating stuff. And again, we've been privileged to see some early draft of some of the forthcoming material. The book working title, The Last Crusade.
Something like that, yeah. I wouldn't be married to that yet. Tom has a way of changing that. So.
Well, that's true, and I will point out that while Chuck Missler said that Exo Vaticana is the definitive work on the Vatican's fascination with what they think they know is coming from outer space, he also hates the title. So I'm sure
I heard that.
So you can talk to Chuck.
Actually, I think that was my fault.
Yeah.
It probably was. I think I named that.
Well, you can run it past Chuck in Idaho and maybe float some ideas for the title for the next book. I'm sure he'll be happy to help.
Okay.
Chris Putnam's website
I'm happy to suggest it.
Chris's website, logosepologia.org. There'll be a link in the show notes to it. Chris, thanks very much for your time today.
Supernaturalworldview.com.
Oh, okay. I almost forgot. I'm glad you reminded me of that one. I'll put links to both in the show notes.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, Knock 'em Dead in Idaho, and we look forward to seeing you again.
Okay, thank you, Derek.
I'm still way behind on reading Chris's work because he can write them faster than I've been able to read them over the last couple of years. But again, the early chapter that I've read, the first draft of the forthcoming book is, and I'm not exaggerating, I think this is the best and most complete analysis of what's happening in Syria and Iraq right now that I've read. Not all military analysts are looking at it from a Christian perspective. Not all Christian analysts are looking at it from an eschatological perspective, a prophetic perspective. And Chris puts all of that together and then combines it with the work that he's done, the research that he's done for the books Exo-Vaticana, Petrus Romanus, and On the Path of the Immortals. And so it's going to be well worth the wait once it's revealed or released, which will be in 2016, I'm sure. So in the meanwhile, keep an eye on his website, supernaturalworldview.com and logosapologia.org. And if you'd rather not worry about trying to spell those correctly in your address bar, just check the show notes at vftb.net. And I will have links in the show notes at vftb.net, which is certainly easier to spell than Logos Apologia, if nothing else. Just a couple of quick notes in the news. The battle for Aleppo is underway. Aleppo's been essentially in the middle of a war zone for about the past 3 years, and things really heated up when the Islamic State moved in next door into that dusty little town of Dabiq. The other interesting aspect of this that we didn't talk about during the discussion was that Aleppo, or rather Dabiq, is in the middle of this Islamic State-free zone that was declared by Turkey and the United States a few weeks ago. It is not Islamic State free because we've not actually gone in with troops to clean them out of there. We've launched some airstrikes into the area, of course, but we've been doing that for a year without any appreciable impact, as we discussed, Chris and I discussed during the program. So what does Turkey do about this? If they want this buffer zone between their border and where the Islamic State is inside Syria, when Russian tanks, Syrian tanks, well, they're made in Russia, but they're operated by the Syrian military. And again, possibly but with Cuban drivers. That appears to be the role that the Cuban forces in Syria are going to play. What happens when those Syrian army tanks roll up to Dabiq in the middle of this zone that the Turks and Americans have declared to be Islamic State free? And the Islamic State puts up a fight. Yeah, it's a tangled web that we've woven there, and you cannot tell the players without a scorecard. And even then, it's difficult. We're dropping weapons, you know, and ammunition to forces that we believe are friendly. But remember, in August of 2012, the Islamic State in Iraq was considered friendly until they morphed into the Islamic State in June of 2014. And again, the Defense Intelligence Agency, the military guys, knew that this was going to happen. They were warning the White House, don't do this, in August of 2012, according to documents discovered by Judicial Watch through the Freedom of Information Act. And the the weapons we were sending there were the weapons that we had looted from the former Libyan army after Muammar Gaddafi was assassinated with NATO's help. It is a lousy time to be an American in the eyes of the rest of the world. So anyway, yeah, so the Russians, Syrians, and Iranian troops, Hezbollah, Cuban forces moving on Aleppo this weekend. Again, that battle began on Friday, and I don't have any new information now that looks reliable, so I really don't know what's going on there at this point. There's a diagram, an image, a couple of images that I saw, satellite images, nighttime satellite images, that kind of illustrate the change in Aleppo from then to now. The first image is March of 2011. Again, taken from a satellite at night, you can see all kinds of lights around Aleppo. The metropolitan area has a couple million people. That's a pretty major city, and it is the largest in Syria. The nighttime satellite photo taken just a few weeks ago shows absolutely nothing. Nothing. Completely dark. No lights at night in Aleppo. 2 million people, no electric lights at night. They've been literally bombed back to the Stone Age. So, next week, I'm sure we'll have more to report on that story, and it will be, well, no doubt getting worse before it gets better. One other story, Sharon and I talked about this on PID Radio. We also talked about this on the Sci Friday update that we recorded for Skywatch TV. Scientists report, well, claim, and I'll just read the headline from the story, because the way the story is reported is actually the important piece of information here, not the study itself. Because the study itself really doesn't prove anything. Quoting, a bizarre experiment claims to be able to make Christians no longer believe in God. That's the opening sentence of this story taken from the Express in the UK, which is kind of a sensationalist newspaper. But that's the claim made by the scientists. They basically use electromagnets and beam EM radiation into your brain. And by targeting certain spots in the brain, change the way you feel about certain things. And they claim that because based on surveys of the subjects before and after the experiment, they were able to make Christians disbelieve in God. Now, why did they target Christians? Why not Hindus, Muslims, Jews, Zoroastrians, Rastafarians? No, they picked Christians because that's the message. You Christians only believe in God because your brains evolved a certain way, and it's a physiological thing, not a spiritual thing. And we can change the physiological, we can invoke create a physiological change in your brain by beaming these electromagnetic waves at it, and thus your belief in God is stupid. That's the key point of this particular experiment, which may, in fact, result in some change in mood. They might be able to change your mood by changing the electromagnetic frequency around your brain. But that has nothing to do with your faith in God, if your faith in God is truly based on the evidence. And sadly, there are a lot of Christians, a lot of people of all faiths, who base what they believe on how they feel. That is postmodernism. Facts don't matter. Evidence doesn't matter. All that matters is how my faith makes me feel. Well, you know, some days you're going to wake up and you're going to feel pretty lousy. That doesn't change your relationship to God. It doesn't change God's relationship to you. Or it shouldn't. But for many people, it does. I suspect that those people who said that they didn't believe in God after the experiment were those kind of people who go to church because the music makes them feel good. It uplifts. It makes them feel more spiritual. Well, forgive me for being blunt, but that's a stupid reason to believe in God. I mean, yes, there are times when the Spirit will lift you and will carry you through times of distress. But if the worship music doesn't uplift you and make you feel right, somehow that means you don't believe in God anymore? Now, maybe I'm setting up a straw man and knocking it down, and if that's the case, then forgive me. But that's the takeaway I got from this particular article. All it did was change the mood, and they interpret that as changing someone's faith in God. There are days when I, you know, have gone through some pretty dark times in my personal history. None very recently, thank God. But it didn't change the fact that as the eyewitnesses of the New Testament report, Jesus died for our sins according to the Scriptures, was buried, rose again on the third day in accordance with the Scriptures. That's still true. My moods will change, but that doesn't change. So when you see a story like this in the news, that changing the electromagnetic frequencies around your head can make you disbelieve in God, don't buy it. It's a meme that they want you to buy into, to accept that somehow your faith in God is nothing more than a physiological response to the way your brain has evolved. An evolutionary adaptation to allow us to handle the reality of death. Sorry, that ain't it. We posted another Gilbert House Fellowship this morning. We studied Deuteronomy chapters 22 through 25. Deuteronomy 22 is an interesting chapter, some deep stuff in there. And the takeaway from that is that God's law is a lot, treats women a lot better than most of the rest of the world. I mean, Judeo-Christian morality, as regards relationships and roles between men and women, is actually a lot more favorable toward women than skeptics and atheists want to believe or admit. So we talked about that quite a bit this morning. Got through three chapters, Deuteronomy 22, 23, 24, and that is posted at gilberthouse.org. And every Sunday, when we are able, we post another one-hour study going through the Bible in historical order, the order in which they were written. So you'll find that at gilberthouse.org. This coming Tuesday night, we begin a series on Skywatch TV regarding the changes in the world around us due to science. And we're calling the series Genetic Armageddon. It relates to the transhumanist movement, and also how science is having an impact on the creatures that have been entrusted to us as stewards of God's creation. I'm talking about our pets. It's leading up to the release of the movie Inhuman, the documentary film, 5 years in the making now? From Defender Films and Skywatch TV, and also a new book by Joe Artis and Donna Howell called Dead Pets Don't Lie. And you'll see the first discussion Tuesday night, 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time, 8:30 p.m. Central Time on Skywatch TV. That's the Christian Television Network, which is DirecTV Channel 376, Dish Network Channel 267, and the Glory Star Satellite Channel 117. And if you miss it, you'll be able to watch it later in the week on the official Skywatch TV YouTube channel and Roku channel. A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod, www.incompetech.com. Remember, we wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.